Whenever I start to talk about generational change, there's always a voice in my head saying, just stop. There's the kids these days problem, meaning we often think our generation is better than the current one. That comes out when we invoke negative stereotypes like millennial entitlement or that Gen Zers don't want to work. There's the related problem that many of you have pointed out on Twitter, that we often have a romanticized nostalgia for the past. And finally, there's the problem of stereotyping some 68 million people, a tendency that would be discouraged under any other circumstance. But at the same time, we can't ignore the fact that we're all shaped, particularly when we're young, by world events, whether that's the Vietnam War, the Great Recession, or the pandemic. And we're also shaped by the way we consume information, be it from newspapers, radio, TV, or now social media. And so when we try to understand the evolving nature of medical education, if we don't consider how generational values and attitudes shift, we may fail to adapt. So is there a way to talk about generational shifts that feels a bit more rigorous and a lot less antagonistic? I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Our first guest today is Roberta Katz, a cultural anthropologist and professor emerita at Stanford, who co-authored the book Gen Z Explained. In the book, she and her colleagues use an anthropological approach to really try to understand how post-millennials see the world and why. Because a lot of the book is about this generation's values, I started out by asking Roberta to describe what some of those values are.
I'll just give you one example. We wanted to make sure that these young people would be willing to talk with us and talk with us about very personal things like values. And so we pulled together a group of about 10 or 12 students for a lunch with us. And we just started asking them questions to see if they would talk about their lives. And toward the end of the lunch, we then said, will you talk to us about values and what you think the values of your generation may be? And to our delight, they leaned into the table and one young man raised his hand very vigorously, like, call on me, which we did. And he said, well, I can tell you what our top value is. It's flexibility. And for older people, that's not something that we typically think of as a value. But he went on to explain that this cohort of people has lived in the midst of so much change from the time they were little that they know that if they don't stay flexible, nimble, they may get left behind in as change continues to happen. They assume change is the norm and that they need to be prepared to respond to change. And when he said that, every other person around the table, every other young person nodded in agreement.
Were there other characteristics that really stood out to you?
They are sensitive to hierarchy for its own sake. They don't mind hierarchy if it has a purpose. In other words, if whoever is leading has the reason to be leading, that's fine. But if it's just hierarchy for its own sake, they're quite dubious. There's a lot of self-agency in this age cohort. They have been used to going to the internet to find information. So there is a little bit less respect for expertise that is kind of imposed on them as opposed to expertise that they seek out. They are used to finding their own answers. And then they are used to fluid structures. So if you think about how young people grew up in doing team projects in school, there would be a project, a team for one project, and then that team would disband and there would be a team for another project. So that's a fluidity issue. In addition to, they need to stay open to change, whether it's technological or social, they need to be open. And so you'll see that in some of the commentary about identity. You know, why are young people so open to people constantly changing their identities? There's a fluidity. There's an openness to what may come next. Now, it's not necessarily all positive. this also creates a sense of, can create a sense of insecurity, and we can talk about that. And of course, this is not going to be, it's not going to describe every single person in the generation. Generational research is, by its very nature, generic, general, but it does, across the board, it is more of a norm than not.
Roberta told me she's often asked to help organizations when they face intergenerational tensions. So I asked her what some of those tensions look like.
So the tensions run the gamut, but they are related to what I was talking about. Some will be that new employees are not just willing to fall in line and do what a boss tells them to do. When older generations were entering the workplace, the norm was suck it up. You know, you got to do what they tell you to do. You got to pay your dues. This generation does not necessarily see that that is the case. So sometimes they will feel like they know better. And the reality is sometimes they do know a better way to get something done because they are more adept often at using the tools of today. So that can create a frustration where they do have something to contribute, but an older person is going to say, but that's not how we do it here. So that brings in the hierarchy question, that brings in the sense of self-agency, that kind of thing. Another area that has come up in the workplace is about retention. Because people are used to, the Gen Zers are used to change, they're not necessarily displaying the kind of loyalty that older people might have expected from new employees. On the other hand, these young people have grown up in an era where employers were not necessarily loyal to their employees. So we're not necessarily giving the message of we're here for you. If you think about the gig economy or you think about the recession of 2008, the message to young people was you can't expect your employer to have your back all the time. So that's another place. There are several of these. Hiring can be another place where young people want to participate in organizations that they feel share their values, where their own sense of purpose can be played out. And if employers are not demonstrating that they are doing some good in the world, it can be harder for them to find young people. Now, that shouldn't be an issue in the medical field. It seems to me that's a pretty easy way for people to say, no, we're doing good in the world, but now I'm getting outside my expertise.
I actually found Roberta's observation about the clash between institutional values and those of employees very relevant to medicine, and especially to trainees. I think most of us enter this field because we want to help people. But then on a day-to-day basis, many trainees feel like they spend their time serving the profit-driven missions of their institutions rather than the needs of their patients. So that value disconnect between trainees and institutions has actually become quite stark in medicine. I also thought it'd be helpful to hear from Roberta, given some of these intergenerational tensions we're seeing, what some of the biggest myths about this generation may be.
The way it used to be expressed is they don't want to become adults. And the reasoning was, see, they don't want to get their driver's license when they turn 16. Well, the answer to that is they had Uber, they had Lyft, they had a sort of more bike commuting, they don't want to get after school jobs. And the answer to that was, when you talk to them, they were like, oh yeah, I earned a whole lot of bit of money on my product placement on my personal website. There were all sorts of different ways that people were getting things done. So some of it is just older people not fully understanding how differently young people are living in the world. So there is some of that. There is some of it is, and it's also this sense that young people don't seem as willing to pay their dues, as we talked about before. And some of that is true, but some of that is they and this is why I'm such an advocate for cross-generational conversation, sometimes they really do know better ways to get something done, and they should have a hearing. But older people are not necessarily used to giving young people that kind of hearing. They see it as we need to train them how to do things.
So it sounds like part of this cross-generational dialogue that needs to be happening, particularly in our training environments, is recognizing just this very premise that they do know how to do some things better than we do, and also letting go of this idea that just because we're older that we are better. I mean, I think that that's part of it, but it's very hard, right, when your authority is challenged. I think that's something that a lot of people are struggling with, this idea that, you know, I mean, medicine has for so long been this apprenticeship, and it's very hard, I think, to people's personal egos, but to the profession at large, to feel like the wisdom that we feel like that we've earned is not valued by certain people. I don't think that this is at all true of the entire cohort of trainees right now at all, actually. And I suspect if you were to study different, you know, professions, that medicine would still have a lot more respect for hierarchy than others among this generation. But I do think that my sense from interviewing lots of people in a leadership, educational leadership position, it's somebody said to me something like they don't trust us to be the authors of their education, which came to mind when you were describing what you've observed. And I think then the question becomes, how do you build that trust? Or is it silly for us to ask them to trust us? Like, because if we're saying that they know things that we don't, like, should we just let go of this idea that we should be the authors of their education?
Oh, I have so much to say. You said that beautifully. So this is a two-way learning street. And part of the reason it's a two-way learning street, the necessity for that, is that we are moving into a future that looks very different from the past. But we don't want to throw any babies out with the bathwater. And young people don't know what they don't know. Just like older people don't have as clear a kind of vision into the future as young people do, because of how they've grown up and what they've seen and the tools they've learned to master. And so the big, my soapbox issue is we need to have much more dialogue because we are at a very crucial moment as we are walking into this different future. We don't want to give, and especially when it comes to the what I would call the human-centered aspects of life that older people are going to know more about. They've lived longer. They've had more experience, interpersonal experiences. And so that has to be understood. And I think young people are very open to having that dialogue as long as they don't feel lectured to. And so they are looking for expertise where expertise is, they know they need it. So, and that certainly is the case in medicine. I mean, established practitioners and teachers have to be able to communicate that wisdom. So it's more about the how than the what.
I asked Roberta toward the end if there's a core unifying message that can help frame this dialogue moving forward.
Maybe that we're building a future that has the best of the past brought into it. I think, you know, that to me, that's the message. Is, you know, that's the message I've been giving to older people, is look, don't just appreciate what you too are going through and what you care about. And 9 times out of 10, it's not that you care about preserving your authority. If you really step back, you're doing that because you think there's something important that you're trying to say to people, these young people, that you want to make sure gets carried forward. So it is really, that is the message to older people, I think, is, okay, let's meet people where they are, but let's understand what we're all trying to do here.
Right. Maybe what gets lost. They feel like we don't see what they have to bring, and we feel like they don't see what we have to bring.
That's the crux of it. That's why I keep saying it's a two-way street, mutually respectful, cross-generational, cross-cultural conversation is the way we're going to get through here. It's just, you know, it's very easy for us to go, well, that's how it always was, so that's how it's going to be, and that's not true anymore.
It's not true, and it's not helpful. I mean, I think that was thing that struck me most as I was writing, because I'm used to writing what I think, and then I'm thinking to myself the whole time, it doesn't matter what I think about the attitudes. Well, no, but they're, like, what I think is not going to shape their values. What matters is that I understand their values and that we adapt our medical training system to those values.
So it's not just adapting to them. It's helping them see what is important. And but it means for those of us who are older, we have to say, well, why is that important?
Right, which is a monumental task. But I think maybe that this dialogue that you're suggesting requires us in the profession to really look hard at our traditions and ask which of those should be carried forward. It's not upon any one individual. It's upon, like, those of us as a group. And so maybe that's my next writing project.
Yeah, I call it first principles. What that we did before is valuable that we don't want to lose in this new context, which is this vast, you know, this, the new tools and the social changes that the new tools are forcing. Exactly. What do we can't lose? And it's there. And young people will know that. They'll pick up on.
In the spirit of advancing this dialogue, especially as we think about how these shifting values are playing out in our training environments, I spoke to our next guest, Dr. Rushen Mark Mabeza. Rushen is an intern in general surgery at the University of California, San Francisco, and given that surgical training is widely understood to be intense, rigorous, and particularly hierarchical, qualities that may clash with shifting generational values, I started out by asking Rushen why he decided to pursue surgery in the first place.
I had originally thought I was going to do primary care coming into medical school, because that is what most intersected with my commitment to racial justice and health equity and all of that. But then I came into my core clinical rotations, and I remember, let me get surgery out of the way. So it was kind of one of the earlier rotations, and I fell completely in love with the operating room. There was something really beautiful about how the symphony of all the people that are in that area, the surgeon, the first assist, the scrub nurse, the circulator, every person that was in that room was functioning to take care of this patient in this way. And it was such a beautiful dance. The minute that I accepted my own belonging, potential belonging in that culture or in that environment, then it allowed me to commit to and accept this budding love for serving people in this way.
Do you feel like you belong?
Yes and no. I feel that I belong when there's a medical student that tells me, like, thank you for making this rotation better. And those moments of feeling that this is what is life giving to me, the feeling that somehow your life, whether you're one person or a patient or a trainee or even an attending, that your life is somehow better because of my presence, that makes me feel like I belong. Now, the part where I don't is very much the culture of almost being called upon to be like a machine. You know, you sacrifice so much of your health, physical, mental, emotional, social, relational, in order to become like a surgeon. And I very much still feel at odds with so much of that.
So that's been the age-old expectation, right? For surgeons in particular, but for all of us to some degree, you make these tremendous sacrifices. You sacrifice sleep, you don't eat, you sacrifice spending time with family, you sacrifice your hobbies because you're going to just give it all for the people who need you. And surgeons, I think in particular, given that they have to be both surgeons and then doctors on the floor, have to give up even more. Do you think that the pushback, your discomfort with that, is a generational shift in mindset?
I will say I certainly feel empowered by my colleagues across the nation to question this current status quo. I do feel in good company. There is a rising generation of physicians, physician scientists, physician advocates, and other hyphen identities that they have that are questioning, at the very least, why what we have is what we have. And some people have also begun to, one, like, break from that mold. Some people who have chosen to, for their own protection, table that conversation until after they've graduated and they're like done with training. And then there are people like myself who I feel is sort of in the middle of that, where I know that in some senses I need to be able to loosely hold this questioning so I can survive the daily demands and the daily expectations and the needs, honestly, of patients and teams. But also knowing that for me to maintain who I am and why I decided to join surgery, I still need to hold it, because that is what makes me me and grounded in the mission that had brought me here in the first place.
You, I think you said something like you feel emboldened by colleagues across the country. And I think that being emboldened is something that a lot of us in the older generations observe, that there is a willingness to speak up. And perhaps every generation is like this, I don't know. But maybe let's just pretend that none of this is new, that every generation goes through this like friction with the one before. What certainly is new are social media and the sense that you are witnessing these efforts by colleagues across the country, perhaps in a way that is so immediate and so like in your face all the time, in a way that wouldn't have been before, because maybe you would, you know, be at a meeting and talk once or twice a year. But now it's like you're walking to work and you're scrolling on Instagram and you're seeing how people are putting forth their values. So can you talk a little bit about the role you think social media are playing in shaping these generational norms?
I think we're seeing a different method of creating solidarity. And I think that's beautiful. I remember 2020, COVID happened, and a national racial reckoning due to the murder of George Floyd happened. And it made me feel much less alone to know that the similar conversations were happening in other medical schools and that similar advocacy efforts were happening. And then, you know, the question of like, what are the values of this generation? I guess I want to preface everything I'm about to say with I'm an N of one, and I am speaking to what I think have been the most impactful for me, as I've heard and internalized from my colleagues across the country. There is certainly a value, I think, now of reconfiguring what health equity and justice look like. There is certainly, especially, after 2020, there was a resurgence of EDI or equity, diversity, inclusion efforts across the country. And even some of the most sort of old school institutions have begun to talk about it in earnest. But then there are now conversations about what are the limitations of that? What does it actually mean for us to think about health justice that isn't constrained and sometimes even diverted away from the community by these institutionalized, quote unquote, EDI efforts? And so I think there's an ongoing conversation and evolving consciousness regarding what that looks like. Second, I think there is certainly more of this ongoing conversation regarding being a physician as a calling versus as an occupation. And there is real tension there. Because on one hand, seeing being a doctor as a calling is wonderful. And actually, I will go say that I do feel that that is my calling. And to me, it is necessary to have that sense of purpose, to be able to keep moving. But then on one hand, it has also served as fertile ground for abusive structures and situations where you are called upon to do work amid such unhealthy contexts and situations. And that is okay because this is your calling. You are going to accept a certain level of abuse, frankly, because this is your calling.
I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of exploitation. What are the abusive situations that you're referring to? Are they things that you have heard, that you experienced as a medical student or witnessed?
I think so much of the abuse that we speak of is actually structural and not necessarily individualized, if that makes sense. And I guess I want to say this as a means of saying that even as wonderful, kind people participate in a system and a structure, that structure can maintain abusive practices. When you have, for example, six interns in one class, like in a general surgery class, and you are covering six services altogether, which is normal, if someone were to be sick or if someone were to be have their family have an emergency and they have to step away, I think it isn't always made clear or even made acceptable for that person to just go up and take care of their own personal business, right? And to me, that is a structural issue. I think other things that are potentially not, I guess in some ways is also structural, is I have heard of countless stories of attendings saying problematic things or doing and performing really problematic behavior that in most cases actually do not get called out in any way, because of a steep power dynamic and hierarchy that disables trainees from feeling safe to give that feedback because that person is deeply entrenched or has a lot of power in the department. And so they don't necessarily call that out. And two, this feeling of helplessness of, well, I have spoken about this and I have tried to give feedback about this and nothing has happened. That's an aspect. And then third, being like, I actually might suffer consequences for speaking out about this that makes it such that the trainee who is more vulnerable by virtue of their level of training, that I think ultimately just allows people to perpetuate those same behaviors while being unchecked.
One generational shift I've observed, which is impossible to separate from the way medicine itself has changed, is an erosion in the belief that being a doctor is a great honor. So I asked Rushen if he sensed this erosion as well.
There is an erosion. Something that, you know, I think keeps coming back to me is the current realities in which we function and the sociopolitical contexts in which we are practicing medicine, I think has fundamentally changed the way we can act within it. The other aspect I think that we hadn't talked about that I think is also important is there is so much more awareness now and consciousness of the deep hurt that medicine as a profession itself has enacted on certain minoritized communities and continue to. And when you, in the face of learning of forced medical experimentation on Black bodies or the loss of autonomy of women or birthing parents, I think people are adjusting to being called into a profession that has had really harmed various groups. And so I think those are the things that we hold. In addition to things have really changed that have been draining our joy from this work, but also what was once this like revered profession. I mean, especially during COVID, like doctors in particular, I felt were really targeted by like anti, you know, population health protection folks. Like the erosion of that position, I think, within society has also been very much felt. And so as a trainee who is going into a profession with these new sets of realities, how do we continue moving forward? I think that is what's important to maintain at this time. To know that you are not alone in this wrestling and that there are still people who are fighting to find that joy in our questioning systems so we can go back to the good parts of what this profession entails, while also reimagining and leaving the carcasses behind of what has been harmful, not just for our patients, but for trainees and current practicing physicians, into a world that is just and humane and humanistic and in service of the humanity that is in all of us. And I, for today, as you're talking to me, I choose to be hopeful.
I genuinely share Rushen's hope, but I think to achieve these dual aspirations, getting rid of practices that are harmful to trainees while simultaneously learning to take really good care of our patients, we have to be able to have this cross-generational dialogue Roberta mentioned. So we have to ask, which of our professional values should be abandoned, and which are critical to maintain. I actually think identifying our values is the easier part. Much harder, especially as these conversations play out online, is figuring out how to talk about them. I'm Lisa Rosenbaum. This is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Our editor is Deborah Molina. Our senior producer is Mary Rose Madden. Music by Blue Dot Sessions. Next up on Not Otherwise Specified, we'll be discussing a concern I heard a lot about from trainees, educational debt.
They have this table and it lists out cost of living. And there's like housing, there's textbooks, educational fund. There's all these categories. And at the very end, it says, et cetera. And it wasn't clear in the beginning, but as I kind of progressed through the first and second years of med school, I realized all my obligations outside of medicine as a daughter, all my small luxuries in life, and all these quality of life events, and that boiled down to, or had to boil down to, the et cetera column.
I'm Lisa Rosenbaum, and this is Not Otherwise Specified from the New England Journal of Medicine. Thanks for listening. Until next week.